Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tense situation on the Ukraine-Russia border, where Russia is conducting military exercises as clashes are underway in Crimea between supporters of the new government in Kiev and Russian nationalists who seized government buildings and hoisted the Russian flag. David Speedy, the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, joins us to discuss how a conflagration might be contained and a return to a Cold War-like confrontation avoided. Then we'll look into the extent to which the U.S. has been taken to the cleaners by Russia and Syria's Assad regime with a chemical weapons deal that has only yielded 4% of Assad's arsenal and keeps him in power while he tortures the relatives of rebel negotiators at the Geneva peace talks brokered by the U.S. and Russia. A specialist on Syria, James Gelvin, professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us to discuss secret negotiations underway in Switzerland between the US, Iran, and Syria. Then finally, we'll examine the new labeling on packaged food announced at the White House that would make calorie counts more prominent, focusing on calories over fat. The president of Eat Drink Politics, Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health, joins us to discuss this first makeover of food labels in 20 years that targets added sugars. And joining us now is David Speedy, the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs and previously a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Speedy.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly with Russian military exercises going on near the borders of Ukraine and with pro-Russian activists, armed activists, taking over government buildings in Crimea, putting up the Russian flag over the Ukrainian flag. You have pretty much a tinderbox, do you not, in Ukraine? And how much do you think Putin is bluffing?
Well, you know, obviously, yes, you're correct. There is a tinderbox situation, but this is not new. This has been going on for a couple of weeks, and just as there have been, just as there are pro-Russian forces in Simferopol taking over regional government buildings and hoisting the Russian flag, so there were also armed, masked Kalashnikov-wielding militants taking over government buildings in Kiev. And I'm afraid what this really means is that the fault lines between East and West and Ukraine, between Kiev and South, namely Crimea, the fault lines that divide Ukraine ethnically, linguistically, culturally, really are playing out along these series of armed interventions and highly volatile and dangerous events. I don't think bluffing is really how I would, upon due reflection, characterize what Putin is doing. I think Putin is obviously gravely concerned about events in Ukraine. He does not need this in any sense of the world, instability in Ukraine. He's got his own problems, of course, within the Russian Federation in the south, in the Caucasus territories, the North Caucasus, in southern Russia. Of course, he's very much engaged in the negotiations in Syria and so on. So, you know, Russia has its own basket of problems and I don't think he wants Ukraine to be added to that.
But after all, though, it was Vladimir Putin who basically has made this a zero-sum situation where...
No, I don't agree with that. I'm sorry. I really don't agree. But carry on. Please.
Well, I was going to say, by basically telling the Ukrainians it's either, us or the EU and it has to be us, the Ukrainians don't have the ability, apparently, to have a system of governance of their own that maybe borrows from both the EU and Russia or is a hybrid of some kind. Isn't Putin the one that's more or less making it a stark choice between him and the EU and making it clear that he's the choice?
No, I agree entirely with one half of what you say, Ian, and that is that the future for Ukraine, if there is to be a stable, peaceful, and prosperous, corruption-free Ukraine, it must be, I don't know if hybrid is exactly the right word, but it's certainly points in the right direction of something that's neither beholden to Moscow or to Brussels or Washington or whatever. It simply must be a Ukraine for Ukrainians and the best governance for that country and not one that's in the pocket of either. I would only say two things. First of all, I think both sides have done their part in creating the zero-sum game. The EU came in with a very clumsy overture toward Ukraine with, of course, a financial inducement that was regarded as inadequate by the Ukrainians. And then, it, of course, if you remember, it put certain conditions such as the release of Mrs. Tymoshenko from prison, which, of course, has happened. But that was seen widely in Ukraine, and not just by Yanukovych, as interfering in Ukraine's internal affairs. So I think, unfortunately, there has been a case of both sides contributing to this idea that Ukraine must be either for us or for them, or with us or not with them. And the other thing is that look, I'm sorry, I think one has to recognize that there is a legitimate concern for Russia in terms of, first of all, Ukraine is its neighbor. I think if we had grave instability in Mexico or Canada, not that it's going to happen, but we would be concerned. There's a historical close bond between Russia and Ukraine. There is a Black Sea Fleet, which is based, of course, as you know, in Crimea, and has a legitimate negotiated contract to be there until 2042. So I think that all of these are seen as, and there have been attacks, sort of symbolic efforts to proscribe or outlaw the Russian language. There have been threats to Russian Orthodox churches. I'm not saying any of these things would allow it to happen, but there's been enough that at least in a symbolic way, I think, Putin has cause for concern.
Well, apparently Secretary of State John Kerry has proposed cooperation in phone calls with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. But Kerry also did make that remark about Rocky IV.
which An unfortunate reference, I think. But
yeah. What is it, exactly was that remark? Because I missed that one.
Well, it was a little ambiguous. Rocky IV was apparently, if I remember my pop culture, which I do not, but I believe that Rocky IV was sort of the heroic little pugilist immortalized by Sylvester Stallone from Philadelphia, taking on a hulking Russian approximately twice his size. And Kerry ostensibly was saying, we're not in a Rocky IV situation. In other words, this don't sort of make that association. The problem is, of course, it evoked images of the Russian bear, of the overbearing, sort of bullying, and so on and so forth. It was not exactly a diplomatic high note for the Secretary of State, in my opinion.
And it did, of course, that film was made during the Cold War. So all of that baggage is brought into that comment, right?
Unfortunately, a lot of baggage from the Cold War persists, and that is an insignificant but telling image that perpetuates that.
Again, I'm speaking with David Speedy, who's the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, and previously was a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Now, apparently in the west of Ukraine, after World War II, there was a very bitter battle between separatists and the Red Army. And so you have histories of guerrilla activity in Ukraine, which would make me think that Putin really would not want to send the military in there. I think that would be a catastrophe. But let's talk about the various regions of Ukraine, because clearly we hear about the division between the east and the west, but there are divisions between the north and the south as well. So just walk us through that, if you will, David.
Well, when I visited Ukraine, I really can't say I was in Ukraine. I was in Kiev. And at that time, I was told that basically there were four Ukraines that we had to take on board. The east, which, of course, is heavily Russian-speaking, pro-Russian. If you look at the results from the last election, it's almost like in this country, the red-blue divide with the eastern part of the country having very, very heavy majorities in favor of Yanukovych, and then in the west, equally heavy majorities for the opposition. And then there is Kiev itself, and of course Crimea, which is kind of sui generis. And with all sorts of complicating factors like ethnic Tatars who were persecuted under Stalin, repatriated to Ukraine after the end of the Soviet Union, and so on and so forth. So it really is quite a sort of polyglot and pastiche of different ethnicities, history, culture. If I may just say one thing about your comment about the end of World War II, Ian, of course, one thing, memories are long, and there is there have been quotes from certain forces in the south in Crimea of Western Ukrainians being pro-Nazi in World War II, and you know, the country being divided along those fault lines. It, of course, World War II ended 70 years ago, but still, as I say, memories are long. So all of these things conspire to create this this really severe internal schism within what ought to be a sovereign country.
Well, my memory of history of World War II in the Soviet Union and Ukraine, it may be a bit cloudy, but I recall that Hitler had, because he was such a racist, had contempts for the Slavs, which is, of course, the heart of being Ukraine, and that had he not been such a racist, he may well have ended up being able to co-opt the Ukrainians to fight with him against the Soviet Union. Is that?
No, I think that's right, but I think that there were ethnic Ukrainians who were collaborators, is my recollection of history.
Right.
You know, the fact of the matter is, it was a sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I suppose, at work. The enemy being the Soviet Union, of course. And the way it plays out in the contemporary situation is that I have been told by people who know the situation in Lvov that there is some sort of ugly anti-Semitic manifestations, houses being daubed with slogans like "Jews live here." So it's unfortunately a situation like this, which you accurately describe as a tinderbox, unleashes a sort of mixed metaphors, a nest of vipers that take on some very ugly manifestations, and this unfortunately is one of them.
And I believe in the south, as you mentioned, the displaced and repatriated Tatars, apparently there are clashes between Tatars and Cossacks going on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And as I say, you know, the term fault line comes into play, and there are so many fault lines in a place like Ukraine. It's obviously a strategically highly important country in terms of location. It's a country that logically belongs to and ought to be part of Europe. I mean, if one were able to sort of wave a magic wand, then both Ukraine and Russia would be part of a harmonious Europe. Both have great European traditions. Russia, of course, is a Eurasian country, but it again is such a pity that the various forces that have come to conspire to create this current situation have created the zero-sum situation of Ukraine as either looking east or looking west.
But isn't Putin basically laying down that Eurasian marker? I mean, he's trying to form that union with Belarus and Kazakhstan.
Sure.
And his appeal is that we're different. We're not like those Europeans who coddle homosexuals, etc.
Well, you know, I did various interviews on Sochi and the LGBT situation. I mean, I completely agree. Please bear in mind that in this country, at least 14 states still have anti-gay laws on the books. It's only been 10 years in a mature democracy that the Supreme Court struck down what we call anti-sodomy laws.
Sure. And by the way, everybody's celebrating what happened in Arizona, but similar laws to discriminate against LGBT people are active in, I believe, Kansas and Oklahoma. I'm not sure of the list of states.
Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, North Carolina, and so on. And there have been prosecutions even since the Supreme Court decision. Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked into that, but you know, the fact of the matter is that Putin is trying to create the Eurasian Economic Union. And the question one would ask, without getting into the whole 22-year history of the post-Cold War period, is what else is he supposed to do? I mean, Russia has gone through a series of things that it regards, from the point of view in Moscow and beyond, as humiliations: the expansion of NATO to its borders, a war against its ally in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia, various rebuffs over things like missile defense and so on. So all of these are sort of, you know, large sort of geostrategic issues. But the fact of the matter is that Russia now feels that it has to look beyond the U.S. and the West and create its own sort of sphere of concern, if not sphere of influence. And I've also written a piece that basically posits the idea that if 22 years ago the Cold War had ended, the Warsaw Pact had been triumphant, and the United States completely defeated, Mexico, Canada, and the European countries were all invited into the Warsaw Pact, how would we respond? I don't think we'd roll over and play dead. I think we'd try to revive our interests in ways that might not play according to the agenda of the superior powers. So it plays a little. I think it really does have a certain relevance to what has happened in the all too brief, but nevertheless, traumatic 22 years since the end of the Cold War.
But David Speedy, Ukraine joining NATO is not on the table.
No.
But obviously, if Ukraine integrates its economy with Europe, it is a huge blow to Russia, who depends upon that market.
It is. And again, I'm not an economist, but one also sort of, it raises the sort of innocent, almost king has no clothes question. Why is Ukraine so anxious to join the EU at this point? I mean, the EU has its own issues, shall we say. The Eurozone in particular has some very serious issues. Ukraine joining the EU at this point, joining an alliance like EU or NATO comes with strings attached and performance issues. And obviously, one would imagine that Ukraine would be a member of a club that would have the same sort of performance at this point, or performance levels as some of the countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain, to some extent Italy perhaps, that have their very severe issues within the EU. So, I'm not saying that for Ukraine we should look upon EU as a sort of poison chalice, but I think it's something that ought to be entered into with sobriety and clear eyes.
Well, it's a country on the brink of bankruptcy, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, in other words, for all of the problems with Greece and the bailouts, et cetera, and this north-south divide that is where Germany's basically saying, you know, we pay our taxes and we're not going to subsidize these lazy people in the south who don't pay taxes and have ghost jobs, et cetera. I mean, if the Germans complained about the Greeks, they're taking on an awful lot with Ukraine.
I completely agree.
So what do you think is going to happen? This is obviously a tense moment. Presumably, cooler heads will prevail. But what's your long-term prognosis here?
Well, you know, my friend here in New York, Steve Cohen at NYU, has written in The Nation that he fears that the Putin bashing that's going on and the general situation in Ukraine, we could be heading for a new Cold War. I stop a little bit short of that. I think there have been other grave moments, such as the Serbian. I was actually in Moscow at the time when the bombing of Serbia was going on, and I can tell you that was a very, very tense and ugly moment to be a Westerner in Moscow. I think that I hope cooler heads prevail. I think that we managed to come together with, I have to say, a certain amount of initiative on the part of the Russians, of Lavrov and Putin on Syria, which certainly in terms of human tragedy is a much graver situation. And so I just hope that, going back to, I think, something you said at the beginning, that the West and Russia really has to sit down in a spirit of guiding Ukraine to a future that is best for Ukraine, of working out the political, economic, and other monumental challenges that exist, and at least coming together in a sort of interim governance situation that buys time, that provides a cooling down period for elections to take place later in the year, where one hopes credible candidates with a commitment to economic reform and political inclusiveness come to the fore.
Well, David Speedy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Speedy, who's the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, and previously was a senior fellow at the Belfast Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent to which the U.S. has been taken to the cleaners by Russia and Syria's Assad regime.